this week on the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine podcast. Welcome back, Blake.
There's sort of four things to consider when talking about treating Budd-Chiari syndrome. Corey did a great job of walking us through the IIH treatment trial.
Blake, what can you teach us about reactive arthritis?
How do we make this diagnosis?
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by host or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by this podcast is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice. It should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We intend to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions are our own and not representative of the University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. New year, same hosts.
And thank goodness, 2020 has finally come to an end.
Finally.
I mean, I think everyone can agree that the year 2020 was terrible.
Well, I just hope that 2021 is better.
Yeah, and
I don't want to jinx it.
Yeah, please don't. I think that there is a lot of hope that we're going to have a better year with the vaccine coming out. Hopefully people can find a way to get back to normalcy. Hopefully we can find a way to get back to conferences and more of the things that make our work so rewarding that have been put off by the pandemic.
I would just love to see people's faces again. That's something I've noticed I really miss. But kind of going off of that sad topic, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Ooh, good question. This year, I am hopeful that in the coming months, the pandemic comes under control. And while that's definitely not a resolution, that's the first part of my resolution being enjoying Nashville for these last few months that I'll be here. But really just enjoying the city, enjoying time with friends, all things that really have been put on hold for almost a year now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm happy to ship Hattie B's to you anytime. I don't know how that would travel, but
we'll work it out. Yeah. We'll so for our first new episode of the new year, we're back with Chief Funky at Vanderbilt, and she's going to talk to us about some really great cases today.
Welcome back, Blake.
It is great to be back. I am very excited to be here with you all in 2021 and hoping that the new year brings me a new and improved podcast voice. So far, we are not off to a strong start.
Blake, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
I would say that mine's pretty similar to yours, Alex. If things open back up and things are safe again, I would really love to get some traveling in before I start my first year of fellowship. And I would love to be able to go check out at least one of the national parks before fellowship kicks off on July 1st.
Yeah, and we didn't even mention, I'm so sorry, you matched. That's wonderful. Congratulations.
Yay. I did. Thank you. I am feeling super lucky and excited to be staying here for pulmonary and critical care.
I know that they're thrilled to have you here. So let's go ahead and jump into our first case. What are we talking about?
We are going to talk about Budd-Chiari. I believe this case is going to make me a bud of the pod.
Oh, not you too, Blake.
Man, you must have heard Lee's last episode and you're just trying to double up on his puns.
Yeah, it's like when people start to look like they're dogs, but Lee and I start to speak like each other. I'm hoping it wears off. Yeah, the first case is coming to us from Vanderbilt. It is, spoiler alert, a case of Budd-Chiari, but what was to me a super fascinating presentation, and I think everyone on Morning Report that day learned a lot. So to set the stage, we have a middle-aged gentleman. He's got a history of sarcoidosis and known to have liver disease, though sort of unclear the extent and the etiology. He came in with 6 months of worsening ascites, was needing frequent large-volume paracenteses as an outpatient. He came to us as a new patient, and as part of his workup, had an abdominal ultrasound with Doppler that showed patent portal veins. He ended up getting an MRV, a magnetic resonance venography, that similarly showed a widely patent hepatic system, and actually ended up undergoing a TIPS, that hospital stay, for refractory ascites, when, surprise, during the procedure, he had an occluded right hepatic vein with venovenous collaterals, diagnostic of Budd-Chiari.
Wow, so he had two different imaging studies that did not show it. Is that a common thing to miss? Do you know?
No, it does not seem to be. The sensitivities and specificities of those two tests vary some, but they're very good tests. You know, they are both considered to be sort of standard initial imaging tests, so it was certainly a surprise for them. The thing that really stood out to me about this case was the insidious onset of his symptoms. Now, I don't know about you all, but when I think of Budd-Chiari, the first thing I think of is this list in my notebook of things that cause LFTs in the thousands. And as someone who's personally not yet had a patient with Bud Chiari, this case made me realize how little I actually know about it.
I remember working this case up in Morning Report. It didn't even cross our minds once we heard the kind of the slow presentation and the clear imaging studies. So it was a total shock.
Yeah. Can you teach us just a little bit more about Bud Chiari in general?
Bud Chiari syndrome is defined as a hepatic venous outflow tract obstruction, regardless of the location or the mechanism of the obstruction, as long as it's not due to cardiac disease or sinusoidal obstruction syndrome, aka veno-occlusive disease. First things first, this is not a common disease. The incidence is only about 1 in 100,000 people worldwide. Interestingly, in non-Asian countries like the U.S., it's more common in women and young adults, likely owing to the risk factors that we'll discuss more in a little bit. The most common causes are those that predispose individuals to clot, like myeloproliferative diseases, malignancies, particularly hepatocellular carcinoma, factor V Leiden, antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, and paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria and JAK2 mutations, which actually can be detected in up to 50% of patients with Bud Chiari syndrome.
Blake, you listed a bunch of reasons that people could have Bud Chiari, but do we normally find a cause, or is there a lot of times that we just say it's idiopathic?
Great question, and I was pretty surprised to read that an underlying disorder can be identified in over 80% of patients who come in with Bud Chiari syndrome, and actually a fair number also have more than one underlying disorder identified. So definitely look for a cause if you have a patient with this.
Is this something that we would consult a hematologist to help us work up?
Another great question, and it depends on what the underlying cause is. Bud Chiari syndrome can be further differentiated into primary and secondary. Primary being a venous process, and secondary being caused by external compression or invasion of the hepatic veins. For example, as you may see with malignancy and a bulky lymphadenopathy or a tumor that directly invades the vein. Now, as you can imagine, the treatment for that is to treat whatever the underlying cause of the obstruction is.
Blake, you mentioned earlier with this patient that this had been kind of worsening for a few months. Again, I normally think of this as more of an acute process. What's the typical presentation, or is there one?
So it turns out that Bud Chiari only presents acutely in about 20% of cases, with those clinical manifestations that I was most familiar with, like you, the acute fulminant liver failure or acute onset right upper quadrant pain, ascites, LFT abnormalities. This patient didn't really have any of those, really had only very mild elevations in their LFTs. More commonly, as it turns out, the onset of symptoms is insidious, taking months to develop symptoms of volume overload and ultimately cirrhosis, as was the case with our patient. And it's very important to note that patients with subacute or chronic disease can actually be asymptomatic owing to the formation of venous collaterals, and our patient did have an extensive veno-venous collateral system.
How is Bud Chiari typically diagnosed?
The diagnosis is made with imaging, which obviously led us astray in this case, but again, this is sort of a weird case. So there's a number of modalities that can be used to make the diagnosis, and I think we are almost familiar with using abdominal ultrasound with Doppler, which is a great test. It's about 85% sensitive and specific, and so usually that's our go-to. But you can also use CT with contrast, MRI, and venography is really the gold standard. Now, aside from seeing the clot in the vessel, there are some other imaging findings that can key you into the diagnosis, such as an abnormal flow pattern on Doppler, venous collaterals on venography, and caudate lobe hypertrophy, which is sort of fascinating to me. I did not recall from any anatomy courses that I had that the caudate lobe has a separate blood supply from the rest of the liver. So as the liver is getting dysfunctional from this Bud Chiari syndrome, the caudate lobe hypertrophies. And so you can see that on even just a normal CT scan of the abdomen.
Once we've diagnosed Bud Chiari, how can we treat it?
There's sort of four things to consider when talking about treating Bud Chiari syndrome. So the first is that if someone has a clot, you want to prevent that from propagating. And so you're going to put them on anticoagulation. Commonly, low molecular weight heparin is used unless someone has contraindications. If the bud chiari is resulting from venous compression, you might consider methods to restore vein patency, such as stenting, or thrombolysis is occasionally used if the clot has been there for less than 4 weeks. And then depending on the degree of liver congestion, TIPS is a consideration to bypass that congested liver and help with some of the downstream effects like refractory ascites and volume overload. At the end of the day, if none of that is effective and the patient continues to have symptoms, transplant is the ultimate option.
Blake, you've mentioned TIPS a few times, and I think that for listeners at every stage of learning, we should sort of cover TIPS, what it is, and how it can be useful or harmful.
Yes, TIPS. I believe that stands for the important procedural shunt.
close, but we're talking about TIPS, the transjugular intrahepatic portosystemic shunt.
Yes, that is exactly what I was thinking of. So TIPS is something that we talk about a lot in the hospital, but I think you're right, Alex. It's important to recall exactly what a TIPS is. So it's essentially a bypass track wherein blood that's returning from the periphery, instead of going through the liver and getting detoxified, bypasses it in a tract made usually by an interventional radiologist because the liver is all scarred down or congested.
Yeah, and I think the goal of this is to reduce portal pressures so that we can, like you said, reduce ascites, reduce volume overload. Also, it can help with esophageal varices as well, because again, that's a problem with increased portal pressures. But when you're taking blood away from an organ that it's supposed to be going to, there can be issues. So what are some of the contraindications or reasons not to do a TIPS?
The liver does a great job of detoxifying substances and cleaning things out of the blood, and one of those is ammonia. And so as you can imagine, if you're bypassing the liver in someone who already has issues with hepatic encephalopathy, particularly refractory hepatic encephalopathy, then bypassing the liver has the potential to make that worse. So that would be a contraindication. Additionally, when you think about the creation of a TIPS and all this blood flow that previously was flowing through the liver and perhaps making its way a little bit more slowly to the heart and not quite as effectively due to those high portal pressures, as Alex mentioned, when you create that bypass tract, you suddenly have this large venous return, this big preload into the heart. If you have this sudden large increase in venous return in someone who has underlying right heart dysfunction, that can precipitate it into right heart failure. So it's important to have an echocardiogram prior to TIPS.
Blake, can you kind of summarize, give us some of your big take-home points about bud chiari?
I would say two big takeaways from this for me. One is that not all bud chiari presents with the acute liver failure that I think of, and actually only a small fraction of it does. Much more commonly, patients present with these insidious symptoms of volume overload. So don't roll your eyes at the abdominal ultrasound with Doppler for patients who have not yet been evaluated. Finally, I still am surprised by how many patients have a predisposition to clot or to venous obstruction as the cause of their bud chiari syndrome. And so always, always do your due diligence in trying to find an underlying clotting disorder or malignancy, something that can explain why the patient developed bud chiari.
So now that we've talked about elevated portal pressures, I hear that we have another case regarding elevated pressures in another system.
You are correct. One of our awesome PGY3s, Corey, presented a case of a young adult male coming in with acute onset headache and decreased visual acuity in his left eye, also with a sluggish pupil, but normal brain imaging. He had a dilated eye exam showing edema of the optic disc and tortuous veins and arteries. And one of my favorite things that our ophthalmologists are doing here now is putting pictures of their dilated eye exams in the chart. It is super cool for people who are horrible at the ophthalmic exam, like I am. The next step was LP with opening pressure, which was greater than 55 millimeters of water, confirming the diagnosis of idiopathic intracranial hypertension, also known as pseudotumor cerebri.
Did you say this was a male?
I did. It was a young male, which is not the typical demographic you all think of. It was sort of driven home to us in medical school that the classic patient with idiopathic intracranial hypertension is a young woman, usually around childbearing age, who's probably overweight. We also think about it in our young women who are on oral contraceptives.
So we arrived at the diagnosis of idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Talk to us a little bit more about the other studies that had to be done and what else is required to make this type of diagnosis.
I would say there's sort of a diagnostic algorithm when it comes to labeling someone as having idiopathic intracranial hypertension, and it's really something of a diagnosis of exclusion. So there are some diagnostic criteria, which are clinical features of elevated intracranial pressure, including headache, papilledema. Patients can present with focal neurologic deficits. And then, of course, have to have that elevated CSF opening pressure, which is why it's so important to get an accurate opening pressure. Patients should have normal CSF cell and protein counts, no concern for infection. We often think of cryptococcus as causing really elevated CSF opening pressures. And then also making sure there are no secondary causes like a mass or something that you would see on imaging.
I mean, that's a great point. This is a diagnosis of exclusion. I mean, it's idiopathic intracranial hypertension. So we really have to rule out all of the things that would otherwise cause intracranial hypertension.
You don't want to miss anything like a meningitis or a mass or something that could be treated. I don't think I've ever seen a case in person. It's just thinking back to in medical school, learning about it. How do we treat?
Well, acutely, the LP and the removal of some of that CSF is probably going to help, but this is not just an acute condition. So how are we going to keep the CSF from building back up? There are a couple mainstays of medical treatment and then some more invasive options depending on the severity of the case. First line treatment is acetazolamide, which is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. Corey did a great job of walking us through the IIH treatment trial, which was a randomized controlled trial of weight reduction plus a low sodium diet plus or minus acetazolamide. And at 6 months, they showed that acetazolamide plus the diet and lifestyle changes resulted in improved visual field function, as well as improvement in the grade of papilledema and CSF pressures. There are a couple other therapies you can consider before moving on to surgery, such as topiramate, which also inhibits carbonic anhydrase, as well as loop diuretics. For those who fail those therapies, you'll consider an optic nerve sheath fenestration, which essentially provides a pop-off valve for pressure in the optic nerve to try to help preserve vision. And you can also consider CNS shunting.
Blake, do you think we have time for one more case?
I sure hope so.
Let's do it.
All right. We have a middle-aged man. He's got a history of HIV and a recent Giardia infection that he's been treated for, coming in with several days of lower extremity weakness and difficulty with urination and defecation. Yikes. Yeah. Am I right? I hear these symptoms, lower extremity weakness, difficulty with urination and defecation, and I get nervous.
Not good.
Not good, agreed. But he did have an MRI that showed some inflammation concerning for an L4 and L5 arachnoiditis related to facet inflammation. He had an extensive infectious workup, which was negative. Then while in the hospital, developed conjunctivitis in each eye on sequential days, as well as migratory joint pains. Is this ringing any bells?
So you're telling us that he can't see, he can't pee, and he can't climb a tree?
That is correct. A rheumatologic workup was undertaken and was negative, but he had a GI pathogen panel that returned positive for Shigella, making this a diagnosis of reactive arthritis.
Blake, what can you teach us about reactive arthritis?
First of all, the definition. Reactive arthritis is defined as an arthritis that's following an infection, but in which the organism is unable to be cultured from the joint. The pathophysiology is a bit unclear, and it's fairly rare, with an incidence of about 5 to 14 per 100,000 per year. The most common causes are GI pathogens, such as Salmonella and Shigella, less commonly Campylobacter, C. diff, and Yersinia, as well as an association with the HLA-B27.
Blake, you said that you can't culture the organism from the joint. How do we make this diagnosis?
So the key here is that it's a clinical diagnosis based on a constellation of symptoms and exclusion of other causes. Something that I think I didn't appreciate was how long between the infection and the onset of the reactive arthritis symptoms commonly occurs. So it's usually an interval of days to commonly weeks between the initial infection and the development of acute asymmetric mono or oligoarticular arthritis. Other musculoskeletal features that can accompany this include enthesitis, or inflammation of the insertion points of the tendons and ligaments, dactylitis, as well as back pain. Now, Alex, you referred to the old adage of can't see, can't pee, can't climb a tree, which is a triad that was formerly known as Rider syndrome. We no longer use that phrase, but that is a form of reactive arthritis.
So what other signs and symptoms can clue us into the diagnosis?
Extra-articular symptoms include ocular symptoms, most commonly conjunctivitis, urethritis, even in patients in whom the arthritis was induced by a GI pathogen, so not just in our patients who are diagnosed with chlamydia, diarrhea, and painless oral ulcers.
Other than the history and physical exam, are there any labs that could help clue us in to this diagnosis?
As with a lot of inflammatory conditions, you might see an elevated ESR and CRP. However, this is a case when you really want to send targeted labs based on your history. For example, did they have a preceding GI illness and you need to send a GI pathogen panel or other workup for GI causes? Have they had multiple sexual partners or having unprotected intercourse and you really need to consider chlamydia? Also, make sure to rule out rheumatoid arthritis. Even though the pattern of joint symptoms is often different from what we see classically in rheumatoid arthritis, that would certainly be a very different treatment than in someone with reactive arthritis. And then it's also important, if there is a large joint involvement, to do a joint aspiration to rule out septic arthritis and gout, which would also, of course, be treated very differently.
And once we've confirmed the diagnosis of reactive arthritis, how are we going to treat it?
The classic treat the underlying condition is really first line. However, it's important to remember that antimicrobial treatment is often not indicated for adult patients with gastroenteritis. So for a lot of these patients, the treatment is going to be supportive in terms of the underlying infection. For treating the arthritis, NSAIDs are going to be our first line for calming down the inflammation in those joints, followed by systemic glucocorticoids for patients who have contraindications to NSAIDs, such as renal disease or bad ulcer disease, or those patients who have pain and symptoms refractory to NSAIDs. But what I didn't know prior to doing a little bit more digging and prior to a great presentation by one of our residents, Andy, was that sometimes these patients actually end up on DMARDs, such as sulfasalazine or methotrexate, as a last resort if they continue to have joint symptoms refractory to NSAIDs and steroids.
What's the typical course for this? I feel like I thought this was an acute thing, and if someone's on methotrexate, how long do people have symptoms?
I was pretty shocked to realize that most patients have symptoms for months. So the joint symptoms can last typically for 3 to 5 months, although there's a subset of patients who can develop a chronic arthritis.
Blake, thank you for being our first podcast bud of 2021. We appreciate you being here again.
Thank you so much. It was an absolute blast. I'm happy to have kicked off 2021 with you all, and I look forward to more pods in the future.
Stay tuned for our next episode.